Yeah. And this is Dr. Mitch. Hello.
Hi, Alan.
I mean, Alfie, what are you doing?
So we're up to the Mishnah on Daf Kuf Yud Dalet, but there was a piece that I misunderstood last time, and I just couldn't figure it out. So let's just review what we know. There are tax collectors, and some of them are not official, so to speak. Meaning, the halacha doesn't recognize them. They really illegally abscond with people's monies. And in those cases, the halacha doesn't recognize the tax collectors. That doesn't come under Dina de Malchus Dina.
And the Jewish tax collector?
So you're asking an excellent question. I mean, it really subdivides into many different categories. Let's take the simple case. The simple case would be, I'll quote to you the language of the Rashba on the previous Mishnah, when the Mishnah says that you shouldn't take money from these tax collectors because the money is stolen money. So the Rashba uses the language, Misim shehitel amel shelo kidin el al piritzon olivad. So the Rashba's language is that sometimes the king decides, you know, he wants to fill up his treasury, he wants to buy 1,000 pairs of shoes, so he taxes the people. So that's not a legal tax. And that's going to be the case of mochsim, who really are stealing money from innocent people. And in some cases that money is going to be stolen from Jewish residents of the city or of the country, the province, and that money is stolen money, and another Jew might benefit from that money. That's something that we want to avoid. There are other situations in which the tax collector is fulfilling what we call Dina the Malchus Dina, the law of the land, and he's collecting taxes rightfully and justifiably. And that's not gzela, that's not stolen goods. Those are monies that are collected properly. And there are different cases, correct. There are cases in which the government is not operating within what we call a valid, legitimate, democratic legal system. It's just the government is simply taking advantage of people and collecting monies illegally. When I say illegally, you know, the king is not impressed by that. He couldn't care less. And if you give him a rough time, he'll throw you into jail or worse. But nevertheless, that's not something that the halacha recognizes. The halacha recognizes the law of the land, but it has to fulfill certain moral, ethical standards. There has to be a justification for the tax. And if there's not a justification for the tax, and the king decides capriciously he wants to fill up his treasury, and he goes and he appoints someone to collect those taxes, that's the case of gzela. That's the case where the tax that's collected is considered stolen goods, or at least some percentage of it is stolen. There are other situations in which the government acts in a very legal way, and the Torah itself recognizes those laws. Now, in the case where the Torah recognizes those laws, then the taxes are legal and they're not stolen goods. But even here, although the government is not trying to illegally take away money from people, but nevertheless there are rules that have to apply in order for the halacha to recognize the validity and the legitimacy of that tax collection. So again, it's not that the government in this case is trying to just steal money from people and fill up its treasury. The king wants to become rich on, you know, at the expense of the poor people. That's not what we're talking about. But nevertheless, we're talking about situations where the tax is collected in a way that's not balanced. What do I mean it's not balanced? Everybody should be chipping in for the tax. Very often, let's say the collection of the taxes had to reach a certain sum of money. There was a certain set amount that had to be collected. And it would be fair if everyone, all the residents and the citizens would pay their share of the tax in a fair way. But let's say, you know, the tax collector comes and he doesn't find the possibility of collecting the tax from everyone. He can only collect the tax, for example, from this group of people who are available for the collection of the tax. They're here locally. But then there are people in far-flung places where the tax collector won't be able to collect the tax from them. So to what extent is it at all possible for the tax collector, let's say he's Jewish, that was the question Elio asked, let's say he's a Jewish fellow and he wants to, you know, live by the Torah law, he doesn't want to violate gzeila and steal money from people, so he wants to make sure that his collection is fair, but on the other hand, it's not always feasible that he could do so and have everyone pay equally, chip in equally, and share the burden of that tax. So that's what we were studying 2 days ago on, what was it, today's, what, Thursday? So I guess it was on Yom Shlishi, right? And we came to certain guidelines and certain restrictions, regulations, when and how it would be legitimate for the tax collector to collect these funds from one sector of the population, one group of residents, and then throw the ball, so to speak, in their court and have them get reimbursed from those who weren't available to pay the taxes. So, for example, in terms of one of the issues, one of the variables that comes to the fore is distance. What do I mean by distance? You cannot expect a tax collector, and the king doesn't expect a tax collector, nor does the halacha expect a tax collector, to travel throughout the entire country, province by province, hassle himself, knock on every single door, and guarantee that he can collect those funds piecemeal from every citizen, every resident that has to pay the taxes. So in this case, the halacha became very lenient, so to speak, became, you know, very compassionate on the tax collector and allowed the tax collector to say the following. You know what? Collect from the local residents, which is called a bikkah. Bikkah defines a certain radius of an area. It's called a valley. And even though the members of the valley are going to now share an undue burden in order to achieve that amount of money that he has to collect, let them hassle and collect the funds from the members of the next bikkah, of the next area. That's their responsibility. The tax collector doesn't have to be matriach. He doesn't have to go to that tircha and go from one bikkah to another bikkah. That was one of the leniencies and the flexibilities that the halacha allowed. Another flexibility which the halacha allowed is the following situation. Within the city, the residents of that city have to come up with a tax. They have to pay the tax. And every resident, let's say, has to pay his share of the tax. Now, what the halacha is going to allow is, in this case, to guarantee that the other members of the city who are right now, at this moment, not paying the tax, the halacha is going to permit the tax collector to take what's called an avot. Ayin vav, ayin bet vav tet. An avot is what we call in English a collateral. So what he's going to do is, he's going to Just 1 second. Let me just make sure I get it right. He's going to take, because last time I got it wrong, so this time I want to get it right. He's going to take the collateral from. I'm sorry. I have to apologize because I got to go over this one more time. Let's see what exactly is going on here. Ben ir avur ben ir chavero shloshilim es misashu atzma kfar para es chavos v'shishkachu din amar sheyochel mashkin echad al chavero. Again, the whole problem is it's not clear to me whose mashkon, from whom is he taking the avot? So again, the tax collector is going to collect the avot from the person who already paid off, and then that's going to guarantee that. Oh, I got it. Now I got it. Okay, it's a bit of a sensitive or complicated calculation. Here's the calculation. The king says to the tax collector that by the end of the year, let's say the annual, what should we call it?
Fiscal year.
Correct. By the end of the fiscal year, X, the following amount of money has to be collected from this particular city. Now, what happens is that if the tax collector is not able to gather together that sum of money from the people, he cannot collect it from the people, because let's say some of the people are not available, they went off on vacation, wherever it might be, you can create your own, use your own imagination. So he wasn't able to collect the tax from everyone, correct? Oh. So now the tax collector is going to have to pay out of pocket in order to satisfy the king's demand. Now you might ask, who would want to take such a position and be a tax collector, knowing that he's going to have to guarantee a certain sum, and if he can't meet that sum, he's going to have to take the money out of his pocket? That seems like a kind of a crazy thing to do. But I think the answer to that problem is that he's willing to do so because he gets a salary for that. Meaning, basically, he's allowed to collect taxes during the entire course of the year, and at the end of the fiscal year, he forks over that sum of money to the king. Whatever is missing, let's say he has to fork over 100, and he collects 80. During the course of that year, the king gets nothing. He'll get the 100 at the end of the fiscal year. So basically, the tax collector could pocket that money, that 80, during the course of the year. Of course, it's not pure profit, because he's going to have to pay that 80 over to the king at the end of the year, plus make up the difference and add 20. Okay. But what does he gain during the course of the year? How do you envision this? How do you define it? What do you say?
The use of the money.
What word would you use to... Well, I don't know, yeah, okay, you're a step ahead of me, but what would you call it, in a sense? What is he doing here, this tax collector? It's a halva. He's borrowing money, so to speak. Who knows? Maybe he cleverly invested that money during the course of the year, and he made a profit on the money. Okay. But now, he's paying out of pocket another extra 20. So what does he do in order to guarantee that eventually that money will come back into his possession? Because in the meantime, he's shelling out that money from his pocket to the king. What he does is, he forces those residents who are local, who are available, to collect that money from the other residents who flew the coop, who are not available. How does he do that? By what mechanics can he pass on the dirty work over to these citizens? Now again, we'll come back to the previous case of the two bickers. You remember the words, one valley and another valley. But in this case, where we're talking about residents of a city, then the halacha is that the tax collector could only collect the tax that each member of the citizen, each citizen of that city is obligated to pay. So let's say 80% of the members of the city each have to pay one, were available for tax collection. So he collected 80 during the course of the entire year. Now there are 20 people who are out in the vacation homes, and you know, they're in the bungalows or whatever you want to call it, the dacha, you can't find them. So what does he do now? He has to some way find a mechanism to guarantee that that money will be paid up. That eventually the other members of the city will fork over the remainder, the balance, in the example I gave the other 20. So how does he do that? That's where the avod comes in, the security. Now here's the chiddush, here's the new insight of the Gemara, allowing the halacha allowing a certain flexibility and compassion for this tax collector. So what does the halacha do? How does it bend the law? It's going to allow the tax collector to take a guarantee, meaning take a possession, a collateral, from those people who are available, who are paying the taxes. Again, these are good guys. And in a sense, they are going to suffer, but let me explain what they're suffering. They are going to suffer because of the other 20% of the city who are guilty because they ran away from the tax collection. And now they become pawns in the hands of this tax collector. And the halacha is going to okay this. That's the big chiddush. And the halacha is going to allow the tax collector to say to those members of the city who are available, if you want to get this guarantee back, you've got to force the other members of the city to pay their tax. This is what I couldn't figure out on Yom Shlishi, and now I think I understand. So what the halacha is going to say is that, okay, the tax collector, number one, has use of all this money during the course of the year until the end of the fiscal year. That's the good news for the tax collector. The bad news for the tax collector is that he has committed himself at the end of the year to fork over to the king X amount of money, and if he doesn't collect all that money, he has to take it out of his pocket. So it's very nice that he had use of the money for the course of 365 days, but now he's left holding the proverbial bag, and that he has to make up the difference. So now the halacha... Now, in addition to all this, he's making a salary for this, which is okay. The halacha is okay with that. But now the halacha wants to be compassionate for this on behalf of this tax collector and allow him some mechanism by which he can guarantee that those members of the community that forced him to take money out of his pocket to satisfy the king and the king's demands will pay back the tax collector. Now, how do they create such a mechanism? Unfortunately, those who are available, who really are not guilty here, I mean, these are the good guys, they become responsible to the tax collector. The tax collector is not going to, there's going to be a quid pro quo here, a give and take. The tax collector is going to say, okay, I'm not going to collect from you guys, from your pocket, your bank account, on behalf of those who are barchu, who have fugitives, who have left the city, but I'm going to make sure that you will collect that money on my behalf. How do I guarantee that you will collect that money on my behalf and you'll run after these guys and make sure they pay him? Because otherwise, I'm not going to give you back this collateral. And the collateral is sort of like an albatross around their necks. They have to now make sure that the tax is collected. Now, you may ask, so why are they guilty? But the answer is because they really should have been paying the entire tax, because the king says the city has to come out with that tax, and it's their responsibility to either shell out or make sure that the other members of the city will pay the tax. Again, I don't know if I clarified this, but I tried to do the best I could. Again, it's a little bit complicated. As you see, you can really lose it. There are a number of different variables here that you have to, you know, it's like a puzzle that you have to fit it all into place. Now, wait a second. There's just one more point that I forgot, and I have to make this point. In the previous Gemara, which was the case of two bikkurs, there... the halacha went even further in a certain sense, allowing the tax collector to collect the entire sum of money from this bicker. And then it becomes the headache of the members of this bicker to sue the members of the other bicker for taxes that they shelled out on behalf of the members of the other bicker, of the other province. What's the difference between the two? In our case that we're discussing today with the collateral there, the tax collector is going to have to shell out from his pocket. He cannot force and he cannot coerce these guys who are available in the city to pay on behalf of the other members of the city. That he can't do. Why is he allowed to do that in the case of the bicker? And the answer is that in the case of the bicker, what we're dealing with is shutfim, partners. Now what happens is, again, this is, I don't know if there's anything parallel in our fiscal, in our financial market, but back in the day, what they did was they allowed all the people ownership over land, and then they would divide up the land into small parcels where each person would work a certain parcel of land, but they were all halachically considered partners, which is called shutfim, in the entire land. So that even though, let's say, Reuven and Shimon were working in this bicker, and Levi and Yehuda were working this bicker, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda were all partners in both parcels, tracts of land. And the tax is imposed on the land itself. Obviously, the collection is on the produce of the land, but the tax is based on the ownership of the land. That's why you may remember that we discussed the case of the Aris. What was the case of the Aris? That was the sharecropper, that he doesn't own the land. His halachas in terms of paying taxes are totally different. Well, so in the case of Bicker, where they're all shutfim, the halacha grants the tax collector the right to demand that in this particular bicker they cough up the entire tax, paying, as it were, on behalf of all the shutfim, because they're all partners in both bickers. But in the second case of Bnei Ha'ir, members of the city, there each member is on his own, independent, he's not a partner, and therefore he's not responsible to pay up for the other guy. Here the halacha imposed upon him a certain element of responsibility, because as a member of the city, he has to guarantee that the tax is going to be collected for the entire city. The bridges can be built and the government buildings and so forth and so on. Now, what happens if the fiscal year comes to an end? At that point, as we said earlier, the tax collector has already filled up the treasury of the king with that amount of money, even though some of it might be his own money. And then he comes to the members of the city and he says, "Oh, I forgot that I wanted to take from you." Can I trouble you for a cup over here? Thanks. I forgot to take from you collateral to force the other members of the city who aren't available to pay the tax, which is now going to be paid into my pocket. The Gemara says that he can't do. He can take a collateral within the course, within the framework of a fiscal year. Once the fiscal year has ended, the tax collector forfeits the rights to take a collateral. Why is that so? The answer is the following. Because until the moment the king has received the taxes, which is at the end of the fiscal year, the tax collector is halachically viewed and defined as the long arm of the government. He is operating on behalf of the king. And as such, the halacha gave him that leeway in order to guarantee that he won't lose any money in the context of working for the king to collect the king's taxes, allowed him that leeway of collecting a collateral in order to guarantee that he won't suffer any loss of money. However, once he's already paid up the king at the end of the fiscal year, from that point and on, he is operating as an independent broker, so to speak, an agent on his own. He's no longer the agent of the king. The king is out of the picture. And now the king says to the tax collector, I've received my payment for the year, you're on your own, and the headache is yours. Now you have to run around to those people who haven't paid their taxes in order to make up for the loss of money that you suffered. As long as the year hasn't ended and the king hasn't been pacified, he hasn't been paid up, up until that point, the king and he, or let's start it the other way around, the tax collector, the moches is considered the long arm of the king. And within that context, the Dina de Malchusa Dina gives him a certain authority, and the halacha will extend that authority on behalf of the Malchus, because he's operating as a representative of the king, of the government.
He's a shliach.
But up until what point is he a shliach of the melech? Until the year has ended. Why? Because when the year comes to an end, he, the tax collector, has already forked over to the king all the sum, the whole year is ended, and now any collections that are related or relevant to the previous year as he entered into the new year, that's the headache of the tax collector. He's now an independent agent working on his own. For an independent agent, the halacha is not going to bend over backwards and allow him to take a collateral from Reuven to make sure that Reuven forces Shimon to pay him up. Now the headache is on the head of the tax collector. Okay, now I'll take questions, then we'll start the Mishnah. I have to apologize to Elio because Elio came to learn the Mishnah, but I didn't get to the Mishnah yet.
Came to learn. Yeah.
Okay, good. Yeah, Lenny?
There's no question... When the tax collector is an agent of the king of Avak interest, if he's using that collateral.
Well, I would say the following. You're asking an excellent question. What happens if he makes a profit on that money? So the question is, who's paying him the profit? If the government itself is going to pay him a profit, then you have a very serious question. And now you have to know what the laws are in terms of ribbis. And you tell ribbis, let's say a Jew borrows money from a non-Jew and he makes a profit on it. Is that a problem of ribbis? A government might be different and so forth and so on. But here in this case, the government is not going to give him any profit. The government is going to pay him for his efforts. It's a tremendous hassle, as you can imagine, to go around collecting taxes. In fact, I imagine that the tax collectors who applied for that position were probably very desperate. And they couldn't make a living. They couldn't, they couldn't get jobs. So they worked for the government. And we may see that in certain cases, the government might even... how do you say in English? Legayes, might conscript a person to serve as a tax collector because the government thinks he's an intelligent guy with a lot of status and he'll succeed and he'll be perfect. In other cases, the tax collector applied for that position. It was a paid position. It was a good job. It was a government job. Probably had a good pension plan. And that's what he did. So he's wearing two hats. On the one end, he's bareheaded. You know, he's working for the government, the non-Jewish king. On the other end, he's wearing his yarmulke because he's working in God's army, and he has to live up to the fear of Shamayim. And our whole sugya that we learned on Tuesday was working out how he can on the one hand work for the government, guarantee that the king gets his taxes, but on the other hand, not to illegally take money from the Jewish people. Again, this is all under one premise, that the government is a legal, recognized government. I call it a democracy, but I don't know. I'm not sure if that's probably not a proper term. But just for our communication, if I use the word democracy, what I mean is a legitimate government that is not there simply because the king wants to, what do you say?
Exploit
the people. Excellent. Great. It's not an exploitive government. The government is imposing taxes because those taxes are justified and they're necessary to keep the country going. Now, the government appoints a little yiddle as a tax collector. What are the bounds? What are the rights of the tax collector within the regulations of halacha to to guarantee that that tax is collected.
Does he collect the tax from Goyim also?
Yeah, he'll collect taxes from Goyim too.
So technically he could take that money before he pays it back, put it on the street, lend it out.
He could take the money that what? That he collected
from the people.
Right.
And he doesn't have to pay it back until the end of the year.
Right.
So he can take that money and lend it to people in the community. The Goyim.
Oh, you mean to make a profit on the Goyim? Oh, you say instead of investing him in the stock market or buying a piece of land and selling its fruits, he might want to lend it with usury. Okay.
I don't think there's a Polish stock market.
Right. Okay, Rabosai. So that's what I have.
Okay. Then the point is
this is what I have up till this point.
Yeah. In learning Gemara before, I thought that the role of the collector was twofold. One is a shaliach, but the other was that he did a deal with the Melech, with the government. In other words, they were collecting £1 million,
right.
Okay, and he said, I'll guarantee the million.
Exactly.
And he was then entitled to collect the taxes with a plus on top of it.
It depends what you mean by the plus. There are two pluses. One plus is that he could use the money until the end of the year, and then he hands over the £1 million.
Right.
That's a pretty good deal. And a second plus is that he gets paid as a worker because of all the hassle and all the effort in collecting the tax. So he gets an employing check.
If you used the word broker before,
right.
If he acts as a broker and he says to the king, okay, you need to collect £1.5 million,
right.
Okay, I'll give you £1 million now, okay. And I'll collect £1.5 million. So he's no longer.
That's what you want to know.
He's still a collector.
Alfie, you have a good Yiddish coffee. I see you're a good wheeler and dealer. I didn't know how chashiv you are, Alfie. You didn't tell me all your credentials. So you're saying, why does the tax collector maybe offer the king the following deal? I'll shell out of my pocket the exact money that you need, and I'll collect more taxes.
Correct.
So I think, again, since the members of this community are Jewish, or at least some of them, that would be illegal, because then he is using his hat as a tax collector to extract money from them for his pocket. And that he can't do. Meaning, the halacha will only allow him to collect money from people because that money is going to build the bridges of the city. If that money, or at least part of that money, is going into his pocket, then he's illegally absconding with that money. So again, if he wants to use that money and make a profit on it, that's fine. But he cannot expand that sum of tax money that he has to collect at the expense of the people. That would be unfair. Yeah. Now, as far as the Goyim are concerned, so that's a complicated sugi that we learned not Tuesday, but the previous week. And we came to the conclusion that stealing from Goyim is not permitted. Deceiving Goyim, it depends exactly if the guy deceived himself, and then there's lifnim mishrus because of Kiddush Hashem. That was the whole discussion that we had last time. Okay, now we get to the Mishnah. And of course, I'd love to tell you that life is getting easier for ourselves, but that would be deceitful. It wouldn't be even Tos Goy, it would be Tos Yehudi here to tell you that life is getting easier. Okay, so what happens now in the new Mishnah? So just to make sure we're all on the same page, we're up to Kuf Yudal and Omen Aleph, approximately, shall we say, about 15 lines down from the top. Masnisin Notlu Mohsin. Now, this Mishnah has one thing in common with the previous Mishnah. Okay. And in that sense, we're skipping all the Gemaras that we spoke about in between, but rather we're putting our head back into the previous Mishnah. And if you remember the previous Mishnah, we were talking about a different kind of a government. Not a government that is, if you pardon the phrase, a democracy, but rather a despotic government that's trying to exploit the people. And that's why the Mishnah says that if you want to take money from Tevas HaMochsim, that you can't do, because the assumption is that those Mochsim, who are representing a government that's exploiting the people, have stolen money, according to Halacha, and it's called Gzela, when they collect those taxes. So again, I'm not going to tell you that every last penny in the in the teva of the mochsim, in their treasury, is stolen money, but certainly some percentage of that money is stolen money. And that's why we don't even want to get, you know, change from that party, from that treasury. Okay.
Even if the people have done Iyush, the ones who have...
So that's what our Mishnah is now going to discuss. That's the subject of our Mishnah. Again, but I just want to point out that as opposed to all the long, tedious discussions that we had in between the last Mishnah and this Mishnah about a democratic government and about Dina de Malchusa Dina and how the tax collectors are governed by the halacha and they're allowed to collect taxes and what they do in order to guarantee that they collect their money or they get reimbursed for the monies. Forget about all that now. We're now back to the previous Mishnah. This Mishnah really belongs to the previous Mishnah. And we're talking about mochsin, meaning tax collectors, that are illegally absconding with property that belongs to the citizens. So this is not, you know, your compassionate government that we were speaking about before, where we apply the principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina. Now, there's one part of this Mishnah in terms of the physical reality which I don't understand. Maybe you'll help me with it and I would be very thankful for you. It seems that the tax collectors would do the following, and that I can't figure out exactly what the reality is. Maybe David, you'll find it, or David, you'll find it in Art Scroll. I don't know if they'll give you some reason for this. But what seems to go on is that sometimes the mochsin, these tax collectors, would illegally confiscate a certain possession, a certain property, and then return it to that same person from whom they absconded.
A replacement.
But it wasn't the same animal.
No,
let's say, for example, we're going to have... It doesn't have to be an animal. It could be all sorts of types of items and merchandise. But let's say the Mishnah says, Notlu Moksim, they absconded Es Chamoro, with, in this case, the donkey of so-and-so. We'll call him Yankala. Okay, let's assume he's Jewish for our purposes. And then Vinosnu Lo Chamor Acher. And for some reason, which is boggles my mind, I can't figure it out, that same moches, I don't know, all of a sudden he did tshuva? I don't know exactly what happens here, but he replaced the original donkey that he took with a different donkey. Does the article say why he did that? He had compassion. Okay, so I don't know. If he had such compassion, why did he take the guy's chamor to begin with? Maybe he was pressured to do so because he had to fill up the king's treasury. I don't know. But at some point, he decided that he's going to return a chamor. But the problem is that this chamor that he's returning was also taken by the moches from some other yid, some other yiddel. In other words, you know, on the one hand, let's say we'll call him Reuven. So Reuven's chamor was taken, and now Reuven is very happy to find that they replaced it with another chamor. But on the other hand, it's not such good news for Reuven, because that chamor that they're giving back is not his original donkey. So he's now stuck with some other Yiddel's donkey. Maybe it's Shimon's donkey, which means it's stolen goods. And stolen goods, as we've said over and over again, have to be returned to the rightful owner. And if you can't find the rightful owner, you're not allowed to keep it for yourself. And he gives another example in the Mishnah, V'chein notlu listim. Okay, we have to figure out why the Mishnah switches from the reish of notlu mochsin, which are the tax collectors, to the seifa of notlu listim. Listim are outright thieves, you know, they are bandits. Es ksuso. And again, I don't understand why this Gazan all of a sudden has compassion. Again, I can't figure that out. But v'nasnu lo ksus acheres. And he replaced it with a different garment. Obviously, a garment that might have been stolen from someone else. So again, the good news is that you're getting back at least some garment from the Gazlan for some strange reason. But the bad news is that the second garment is not your original garment. So you're not getting back that which is yours. You're getting back that which was illegally stolen from someone else. And the Mishnah says, you know what? It's not such bad news. Why is it not such bad news? Harei Eul Shalom. In other words, the replacement donkey or the replacement garment now is rightfully owned by the person who received it. Why, says the Mishnah, Mipnei Shehabailim Misyashim Mehem, that the original Nigzal from whom this donkey was stolen gave up hope. He despaired. Now, I want to make two points here as I try to rack my brains in understanding this Mishnah. Number one, is this an assumption on our part? Meaning, is the Mishnah presenting the thesis that we can assume that the owner, the original owner, we'll call him Shimon, right, whose garment is now getting to Reuven, he gave up hope? Is that an assumption on our part? Or, as we're going to soon see, there are situations in which two witnesses could testify that we heard the Yeush. We actually were there and present on the spot when he declared, I give up hope, I know I'm never going to get it back. So therefore, if Yeush kicks in, I'm not sure exactly, Elio, if it's Hefker, maybe if we want to round it out a little bit, we'll call it Hefker, but if we want to be very...
He gave up hope on it.
Right, I don't know if it's Hefker, because again, you know, you really have to... A lot of what we're learning today depends upon the second perek of Bava Metzia, which is, you know, like 100 block from here, which I don't think we're going to get to in the near future. And that is where the Yeush is the same as Hefker, if it's not the same as Hefker, but if, again, if it helps you, we'll round off the edges here, you know, we'll sort of round it out and call it Hefker, but I don't like to use terminology that I don't understand, so I'm going to use the word Yeush, and we'll stick to the word Yeush. And now we get to the premise that I think underlies this Mishnah. And what is that premise? So I'm going to offer two possible answers to that question. I don't know which one is correct. One answer is that once there's Yeush, the Gazlan himself now acquires ownership over the object. What that means is the following. A Gazlan, when he steals something, acquires, we'll call it quasi-ownership, meaning partial ownership. The ownership of the Gazlan is incomplete. Why is it incomplete? We discussed this in the past, if you recall. There's a barrier that prevents the Gazlan's kinyan, his acquisition, from being complete. Does anybody remember what that barrier is? The heshiv is hagzela shar gazal. The fact that the Torah says you have to return the gzela. So you can't call it your own if the law requires that you return it. That's not called ownership. So theoretically, in potential, you know, we have like a... Imagine you have a racing horse, you know, but the problem is that there's a steel door, you know, that doesn't let the horse go out. So potentially this horse can really fly, but you have to remove a barrier. So on the one hand, the Gazlan made a quasi kinyan and he acquired ownership by stealing it. He took it into his rishus. He has possession over it, but he has to give it back. And as long as he has to give it back, he cannot acquire full ownership. Comes along the Mishnah and says that if the Nigzal, from whom the victim of this crime, gives up hope, at that point we remove the Chiyuv Hashava. He no longer, the Gazlan no longer has to return it, and therefore that the horse runs. Meaning the original Kinyan Gzela now could complete itself because we remove the barrier, namely the Chiyuv Hashava. What power, what does Yeush effectuate? Yeush removes the Chiyuv Hashava, the responsibility on the Gazlan to return the object. Meaning, as long as the Nigzal is hoping, he's holding out for the possibility of getting it back, at that point, he's demanding Hashava. But if he drops the ball, so to speak, and he waves his hands in the air and he says, there's no chance that I'm going to ever get back, with that Yeush, that despair, the Chiyuv Hashava is completely removed, and therefore the Kinyan Gazlan is complete. There's another way of learning this Mishnah. And that is that the gazlan cannot be kona b'yeush, but if we add another power to that yeush, A plus B, then there could be a kinyan. And what's the other power, Mitch?
Shini
rishus. I don't know about Shini Hashem here, because nothing has changed in the actual physical makeup of the donkey or the ksus, but the rishus, the possession, is a whole new possession. So as long as the gazlan is in possession of it, so yeish is not enough to create a kinyan. At what point does the kinyan get clinched? At the point in which the object that was stolen was transferred from the possession of the thief over to the possession of he who received it. And in that case, we have not just yeush, but we have yeush plus shinui rishus. Now we'll go on in the Mishnah. Hamatzil min hanohar. So Reuven's object has been swept by the tides, and Shimon comes along and he saves the object. O min hagoyim, which means, oh, I'm sorry, min hagayas, I'm sorry. I have to fix my glasses. I mean that literally, by the way. I just don't have time. But O min hagayas, which means that there was a battlefield, and in the battlefield, the soldiers confiscated someone's possession, in this case, an object that belonged to Reuven, and now Shimon somehow got it out of the hands of the soldiers. In such a case, we still have another case. Oh, min alistim. Okay, now watch this. In the first case, we had an object that was being swept aside, swept along by the river. In the second case, it was being taken by the soldiers in the battlefield. In the third case, the object was taken by listim. Now, listim, at this point in our discussion, we may change our mind, those are gazlonim, they're thieves. And somehow, Shimon was able to get Reuven's possession out of the hands of the listim, of the gazlon. And here the Mishnah says clearly, Im nisyashua bailim, which means, if we have testimony to the effect that the original owner made a declaration, I give up hope, that's called vaili l'chisaron, because I'm not going to get it back, then hareu shalo. Then Shimon could keep it, because Reuven made that explicit declaration, and we have evidence to that effect, implying that in the absence of Reuven's statement that I am Messiah, Shimon has no rights to the object. Now again, when we go back to the first part of the Mishnah, I offered you two possibilities. And I was wondering, when the Mishnah in the beginning says, Mipnesha habaylim misyashivihem, does that mean that we know, we heard, we can testify to that effect? Or does it mean we assume that the bailim is misyashim? And I would submit to you, based on the different languages, the nuances of different languages from the beginning of the Mishnah to the end of the Mishnah, that in the beginning of the Mishnah, we can assume that he was Misyash. In the second category of the Mishnah, of the Matzil, we'll call it, which has three scenarios, Im Misyash Rabbayim. There we have not the language of Mipnesha Misyash Rabbayim, but Im Misyash Rabbayim, which means we're going to have evidence to prove that there was Yeish. So for some reason, the case of Listim in the Sefer is different from the case of Listim in the Reisha. Because after all, in the Reisha we said that not lo Listim, then you can, you know, you can keep the object and it's yours because of Yeush as a presumption, as a premise that we assume. In a listim in the Sefer, there we need an explicit statement of Yeush, and we need evidence to that effect. What happened here? What's the difference between the first listim and the second listim?
Could be in the ratio you've actually paid. If you get an inferior donkey from the original donkey that you gave, then you're actually paying.
Well, you're paying to whom? I mean, but I'm saying, if you want to pay for stolen goods, you have to pay it to the Nigzal. I mean, the Nigzal is not getting back his chamor. Are you with me on that?
In other words, to the Nigzal.
Well, again, I don't know who the Nigzal is. The tax collector. Oh, you want to say that what? That the tax collector
he gave you an inferior donkey, so you're But again,
the question here is whether you could keep the inferior donkey, as you call it, right? So the person from whom that inferior donkey was stolen, was absconded, he didn't get back a donkey.
No.
So that can't be returning a gzela. Now, if you want to make a claim to the donkey, the replacement donkey, you would have to somehow pay back the person who owned that donkey, and that you're not doing.
You physically losing money doesn't count as
money. No, that's not. You know, you can't just take. You remind me of the Gemara about Zorak Yamamelach. You know, if you had illegal benefits or something, so you take the equivalent of its money and you throw it into the Dead Sea.
Didn't we have earlier that if the river sweeps something away, then it's automatically not belongs to anybody?
That's another question. You're just making life even more miserable for me. Okay. Mitch is pointing out that why does the Mishnah say im nisyashu abayim? Forget about nisyashu abayim. If the river is carrying it away, I don't need to hear yeish from the abayim. I know that he's misyash. And that's a sugya called zuto shel yam.
But there was a distinction of where it was, how deep it was, and what you need an expert.
Correct. Down together. Correct. Maybe there are differences. Then the Mishnah adds another case here. V'chein, there's another case where you could allow for certain flexibility, and that is Nachil Shel Dvorim, which is some sort of a group, a cluster of bees. You know, bees were considered expensive because, you know, it's not so easy to capture bees and to raise them. What do they call them today? I think there's a word for that. No?
Swarm of bees.
No, but what's called, is there a name for the miktsoa, for the discipline of somebody who raises bees, a bee raiser? Is there? Okay. All right. We're all a bunch of amaratsim here. Anyway, there is a word for this, you know.
There is a
professional bee grower, you know. A honey potter. Okay, we call him honey potter. Okay, you're reading too many Potter movies. Anyway, so what do we have over here? Nachil Shel Dvorim. Okay, so let's say there's this group of bees, and somehow they flew out of the beehive and they came into my beehive and they joined together with my bees. So now I've doubled the volume of bees that I have. That's pretty good. So again, in this yashu, if the original bailim who've lost their bees, have given up hope of ever getting it back, then hare elu shalo, then I gain from the fact that they were misyash. But again, we need an explicit yesh. So that's what I call hakafa aleph. Now we get to hakafa beis. Omar Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, and the question here is, who can give testimony? Let's say, for example, the bees are flying through the air, but we don't know from whence they came. And maybe there's one person or even more than one person that is claiming those are my bees. You know, they came from my beehive. So we need testimony. If Reuven and Shimon are arguing about whose bees these are, then Reuven, in order to prove his cause, his case, he would have to produce the evidence of two witnesses. So comes the Rabbi Yochanan Broka with a major breakthrough, and he says, "Nemenis isha katan lomar mikan yotza nachil ze." A woman who's normally not kosheli edus, a katan who's not kosheli edus, is allowed to be, is given, granted credibility to be believed as if he were or she were an aid, a kosher witness, to say that we saw these bees flying from this hive that belongs to Reuven. And the Gemara is going to have a long discussion here on Kuf Yudalad Amid Beis as to why Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka in Dine Momenos, in monetary law, where the Torah requires two kosher aidim, is willing to rely on one witness, and not only that, the witness might be a woman or a child. Then he goes on and he says, "Umahalech betoch sde chavero." This is fascinating. Normally, as you and I know, you're not allowed to trespass into, you know, without getting permission, into the field of your friend. You can't go into his house or his property. You can't do that. But here, Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka says that you're allowed to do so. Why? What happens is your bees are flying into your friend's field. You're allowed to even without permission, enter into that field, lahatzil es nechilo, in order to get back the group of bees. In other words, I can't go into your possession just to shoot animals, let's say, if I'm a hunter, you know, and decide that I want to, you know, I want to take things that are hefker, and don't, you know, they're not yours, these are wild animals that go through your property, and I can't just go in there and shoot them down. I have to get permission from you to enter into your possession. But here, because of the fact that there's some sort of hatsola to save you from a tremendous loss, we're going to allow you, and there's an urgency now, immediately, to go into your friend's field without permission. But there is one proviso. It's not like you own his field, you know, and you can do whatever you want in his field. In Hizik, if Toch Kedei, as you're trying to gather back your bees, you damage his possession, you know, you stomp over his tomato patches, then the Shali Masha Hizik. You know, we're not giving you a carte blanche, you know, absolute permission to do whatever you want without any element of responsibility. You're going to have to be very careful, because if you damage his property in the course of saving your bees, you're going to have to pay for that. Avolo Yokuts es Socho. Okay, now Rashi seems to identify socho with a sukkah, meaning a small, and the Israelis here call it a budka, if you know what I mean, like this little hut. And what happens is that the bees, if they land on this hut, it's very difficult to take each bee as you climb up onto this, you know, the roof of this little hut and reclaim that bee one by one. That's a difficult thing. So maybe what you could do is, and this would save you a tremendous amount of effort, you can cut down this hut, and all the bees will land on the bottom, on the ground, and then you can collect them. And the Mishnah wants to tell you, you're not allowed to do that, even though, you have to add that word, even though al menas litein es domim, even though you're willing to pay him for that. In other words, here's the following question: can I damage your property for the greater good of saving my possessions if I'm willing to write a blank check up front that I will reimburse you for any loss that you suffer? And the answer is no. You know, the ends don't justify the means. There's a prohibition that prevents you and enjoins you from damaging someone else's property, even if you want to pay him back for that, and even if you're doing it for a greater good. That's the shita of Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka. But fascinating is that Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka had a son by the name of Rabbi Yishmael, and he had a different opinion. And the poskim here are going to go to town. Are you allowed to disagree with your father? You're not allowed to disagree with your father. That's a side issue here. But he says, af kotzeitz, he's allowed to cut down the hut, and that's justified for the sake of saving his bees. V'nosen es adamim, because he, you know, he's willing to pay for the hut that he destroyed. Now, it's interesting. It doesn't say in Rabbi Yishmael in the Sefer, al menas litein es adamim. Do you see how the language changed? It says, no sein es adamim. So I think what's going on here is the following, that there was a historical change here between the life of the father and the life of the son. Again, I don't know how many years went by, but let's say 30 years went by. And at some point, Beis Din got up and they made a takana. And that takana was instituted during the lifetime of Rabbi Yishmael, and they said, no sein es domim, as long as you're willing to pay for the damages, then Beis Din is going to make a special allowance to permit you to break down someone's, in this case, his sukkah, in order to save your bees. I just want to see what time it is. Time for mincha? Okay. So then, We at least accomplished the Mishnah. If you think the Mishnah is complicated, you haven't seen anything yet. Now, that's not a good marketing, you know, thing for next week, but I have to tell the honest truth, life is going to get more complicated here, because we're going to have to talk about whether Yeish is a Kenyan for Gzela, is it not a Kenyan for Gzela, Yeish plus Shina Rishus. What if the Shina Rishus took place before the Yeish and not the reverse? And when do we assume that there is Yeish? When do we not assume Yeish? When is it, you know, the case of a gazlan who actually accosts a person face to face and he takes his money? There, do I give up hope? Or on the contrary, since I saw him, I won't give up hope? As opposed to the case of the ganav who stealthily sneaks in and I don't know who he is. Do I assume that this guy's afraid of me? He's gonna, you know, if we find out who he is, you know, we have the security cameras, we'll find him and we'll make him pay. On the contrary, since I don't know who he is, I give up hope and I don't have a chance of getting it back. All that is gonna come in Mirza Hashem on Yom Shlishi. Okay then? If I don't see you, gentlemen, we'll have a great shot.
I think the term is beekeeper.
A beekeeper? Okay, we'll call it a beekeeper.
This theory of Yeush doesn't get...
Do you want to do me one favor, David? So just open the door so we know when they're...
The Yeush on the first halakha of the previous mission with the coins in the jar. You're not allowed to take them even for exchange. Yeush doesn't seem to get you off the hook there. You can't exchange 100 for 520s in the first halakha of the previous mission.
Right, because there was never Shini Rishus in that case. In other words, it's always in the possession of the Moches. Here we're talking about where the Moches took this Chamor that he absconded with from Shimon and he gave it to Reuven. Uh-huh. So then it's Yeish plus Shini Rishus.
I'm going to win it.
Oh, you won't be here? All right, Fargus with the Hay, we'll miss you. When are you coming back? Oh, okay.
I'm not to miss this idiot.
You timed it perfectly, so you don't have to learn this complicated sugya.